All right. Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. Today, I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live from WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois, here at Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Today, we've got a guest we've been waiting for a very long time to have, one of our favorite guests and one of the most important writers in the United States today, Barbara Ehrenreich, a famed journalist and social critic, will be on the air with us live talking about her brand new book, Bait and Switch, The Futile Pursuit of the American Dream. So join us today for a live version of Media Matters. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
Congress will soon begin working on an overhaul to the Telecommunications Act of 1996. A rough draft of new legislation just began circulating on Capitol Hill. 9 years ago, the Telecom Act was written in secret, parts of it penned directly by media and telecom industry lobbyists. Celia Wexler is vice president of advocacy for Common Cause, and she says that was a mistake.
No member of the public really had a seat at the table. The public interest was not represented. And that resulted in higher cable and telephone rates and a huge sweep of media consolidations, media mergers that deprived us of diversity, deprived us of different viewpoints, and eliminated competition, and we certainly don't want that to happen again.
This time the stakes are even higher. Consumers Union senior policy analyst Janine Kenny says what Congress does will likely determine how broadband services are developed, and concepts like public access and universal service hang in the balance.
From whether or not you as the average person will be able to access whatever content you want on the Internet, or whether your Internet service provider could block that content, to whether or not you'll have any options for alternative video service providers in your community.
This is why a coalition of more than 20 public interest groups, including Free Press, have signed on to a joint call for wide-ranging debate on the future of telecommunications laws in the United States. Celia Wexler says this debate should include a series of public hearings.
Perhaps at least four or five in cities that are kind of regional hubs, so that you are make sure you're not just listening to the coast, that you include the Midwest, that you include the Southwest. You also have to hear from, different kinds of consumers, low-income people that live in big cities, as well as rural people that live in remote areas, to get a really good sense of the communication needs of the American population.
The process of drafting and approving a replacement to the 1996 Telecom Act is expected to take months, with committee votes in the House and Senate not even likely until next year at the earliest. In related news, calling it an opportunity he just couldn't refuse, the chief of staff for embattled House Majority Leader Tom DeLay resigns this month to work for Time Warner. 37-year-old Tim Berry says he planned to stay with DeLay until Time Warner officials began aggressively courting him earlier this year. He'll make a sweet six figures as the company's top lobbyist in D.C., using the influential connections he's cultivated to advance the interests of his new employer.
The broadcast industry is trying to turn the destruction of Hurricanes Katrina and Rita into political points. Congress is currently considering setting a hard deadline for TV stations to fully make the switch from analog to digital broadcasting. When the switch takes place, the analog TV spectrum will be recycled for other uses, one of which is the creation of a robust nationwide radio communications network for emergency responders. But the National Association of Broadcasters is hyping its members' hurricane coverage as reason why TV stations should continue to broadcast in both the analog and digital bands. As of now, TV broadcasters are slated to relinquish the analog spectrum at the end of next year, but it's likely the deadline will be pushed back to at least 2009. Meanwhile, most broadcasters only provide emergency information in a single language, English, and that's left many Gulf Coast residents high and dry in terms of knowing when and how to evacuate safely and where to go to get disaster relief. The Minority Media and Telecommunications Council, Spanish Broadcasters Association, and the United Church of Christ have petitioned the FCC to require that emergency alerts be relayed in English and Spanish at a minimum.
Although the board of directors at Clear Channel Communications handily won re-election earlier this spring, newly released documents from the company's largest institutional investor show the vote was nothing close to unanimous. At the time of the shareholder election, Fidelity Investments held more than 15% of the company's shares, and it also manages Clear Channel's half-billion-dollar 401k fund. Yet it voted no on the re-election of the entire corporate board. Fidelity disapproved of the opulent golden parachutes bestowed upon Clear Channel's founder, Lowry Mays, and his two sons, CEO Mark and CFO Randall. The deals require the company to give each of them severance equal to 7 times their salaries, a hefty bonus, and 1 million stock options, packages cumulatively worth about $90 million. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois, on a dreadful September afternoon filled with rain. We're not so beautiful today in Urbana, Illinois. Today we've got a terrific show for you. It's a good day to sit inside, turn up the radio, make some tea, and enjoy yourself. Our guest is someone we've been trying to get for some time now, and we're fortunate to have her on the phones live. Barbara Ehrenreich, the author of the brand new book, Bait and Switch, The Futile Pursuit of the American Dream. Barbara Ehrenreich has been a guest on this show in the past 3 years ago, and she was a guest on my first show back in Madison, always at fortuitous times. I think the first time I had Barbara Ehrenreich on was the moment of the O.J. Simpson trial jury announcement, which we carried over the air, which is probably the only community station in America that did that. And then 3 years ago, we had Barbara Ehrenreich on, and she was at a benefit for Paul Wellstone, the senator up for re-election in Minnesota. Tragically, as you all know, shortly thereafter, Paul Wellstone and Sheila, his wife, died in a plane accident. Today, though, we're on better news in terms of the world, we hope. Nothing tragic to join us in a personal sense. We have Barbara Ehrenreich's new book, Bait and Switch, to discuss. It's a pleasure, Barbara, to welcome you to Media Matters.
Glad to join you again, Bob.
Yeah, and nothing as great as the OJ trial, unfortunately. But this book, which I had the privilege of reading this weekend, is really a treat. I really enjoyed it. And I have to say, I think what's been lost in the shuffle about Bait and Switch, which we're going to talk about, has been that, you know, you wrote a terrific book on the middle class about 15 years ago called Fear of Falling, which is one of my favorite books. So this is not your first time into this turf by any stretch of the imagination, although that might be lost to people who just picked up your work in more recent times.
Well, I've been thinking about class in America for a long time,
mm-hmm.
maybe 30 years,
mm-hmm.
you know. Or writing about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, let's talk a little bit. You know, the book you wrote just before this, Nickel and Dime, got a lot of publicity. I suspect it was your best-selling book. It was about, you know, you going undercover as a working-class, unskilled laborer in America. And then this book seems like such a change. Now you're going upper middle class and heading out into the labor world then. Why did you decide to do it, and what did you expect when you came up with the idea?
I decided to do it because, you know, I've got a lot of letters coming from readers of Nickel and Dimed, generally from people in pretty bad circumstances, people facing eviction notices or who have been diagnosed with something really dreadful and have no health insurance. And I began to notice that a lot of these people in these situations were said that they had college degrees, even master's degrees, that they had once held what they thought were secure and, of course, were decent-paying jobs. I'm not talking upper middle class here, really, more middle class,
mm-hmm.
people whose wages might be in the, you know, $40,000 a year and up. And, you know, that struck me.
Yeah.
What is going on? This is another side to poverty that I had not thought about, was people falling into it, although they had all the credentials one would imagine, do much better.
So you decided to maybe look into this part of our population a little bit closer, and you decided to use the same approach you took to Nickel and Dime and actually join the labor force. So why don't you talk a little bit about that? And I also explain, since I read your book, I mean, you are a celebrity of sorts now. So, I mean, you're not, I mean, your name at least, people might not recognize you personally, but I think once they see your name, it's around enough that especially in certain circles, you aren't going to be able to get by that easily.
Well, that's why I was really undercover here, Bob. I did change my name. I went back to my maiden name because I was, thought there was a possibility that my real name would be recognized. And I had a fake resume as a PR person, looking for a corporate PR job. A fake resume, but I should say based on connected to real experience and claiming those skills I don't actually have. So I felt kind of comfortable.
Plus, it was a resume that if someone were to call up a prospective employer, it would check out. It wasn't like filled with blatant lies.
That's right, because I had people lined up who would...
cover your lies.
Yeah. Right. And there was...
That sounds pretty normal, though, doesn't it?
Huh?
That doesn't sound that unusual, actually.
No. not at all. And, the thought was that here there is one way to find out about this downward mobility, and that is to enter the ranks of the white-collar job seekers. I thought I might actually get a job within a few months, and then I'd have to decide whether I wanted to continue with that or go look for another one or something. But that was my idea, to enter the ranks of the white-collar job seekers, the people who are being downsized. There's so many euphemisms for that, right-sized, smart-sized, et cetera, reorged, outsourced out of their jobs, and to spend some time within their world.
We're talking to Barbara Ehrenreich today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Barbara Ehrenreich is the author of the brand-new book from Metropolitan Books, literally just came off the presses this month, Bait and Switch, The Futile Pursuit of the American Dream. Barbara Ehrenreich is the author of Nickel and Dimed and 13 books in total, well-known social critic and journalist who's written for Harper's, The Nation, been a columnist for The New York Times. It is an honor to have Barbara Ehrenreich with us. If you'd like to call in to talk about Bait and Switch or any questions or comments for Barbara Ehrenreich, the phone number here at Media Matters, 333-9455, the toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Barbara, at the beginning of the book, you have the conclusion, the concluding paragraph of your introduction makes some really stark statements about, what you had expected when you went into the world of the white collar after coming out of nickel and dime, the differences you expected, how much easier the life would be, the sort of glorified surroundings you'd be in, what a nicer life it would be. And then you said at the end, I don't have it in front of me, but that you were 100% wrong, or you found out you were completely wrong. Could you, talk a little bit more about the expectations and maybe some of the misperceptions people have who are not in the corporate world or who are not in this sector of the economy about what their life is like there?
Well, I wasn't exploring the whole life. I was focusing on the job search.
Yeah, that aspect of it.
And I thought as a project, this would be a lot easier than nickel and dimed, which was, of course, a physically very exhausting project, doing blue-collar manual labor. But I found that this was harder. This was actually harder. For one reason, I don't know how to put it this way. Blue-collar work is somehow more straightforward. It's not paid well, of course, but you know what the job is, you do it, or it gets done or it doesn't. Right? The floor gets scrubbed or it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you're paid for. I felt in the white-collar world, it is a lot harder to know what is being asked of people, and that a lot of what you're being told all the time by career coaches and business advice books and networking group leaders is about not your skills or your experience, but your attitude, your personality, your likability. You hear that over and over, that's what matters. Those are the important things. And I think that's kind of difficult. And it must be a lot more difficult to focus on having this really upbeat personality and everything if you really have just been laid off or downsized or something. You're being asked to be an actor.
You talk about how you expected to get employment pretty quickly and with your writing skills, obviously, that you would be able to, someone would see what you could do. But in fact, I don't want to give away the plot of the book, but much of the book is about you're going through the various networking, job fairs, career counseling, various types of sessions to get you in a position to get a job in your efforts without ever really fully having success. So the book is really almost a preamble to about being inside the corporate environment, but you seem to have learned quite a bit about the corporate environment from the job search process. Is that fair to say?
Oh, yeah, because you're learning what people want, what they look for, and you're told again and again that it's not how brilliant your resume is, that this is a decision. The hiring decisions are, as one place put it, 90% emotional, based on how likable you are.
And, of course,
who you know, who you've managed to network with.
Yeah, you go through all these chapter after chapter on networking, on career counseling, on these various meetings and seminars that you attend. And for those who haven't read Barbara Ehrenreich, understand this is done with elegant wit as well as incisive social commentary. This is a very enjoyable book to read. And as I'm reading it, I'm thinking, boy, someone could do a wonderful satire if they wanted to do a play or something on this. But it's such a tragedy at the same time. But you're going through all this. Is this standard? I mean, did you decide – so I was reading this. I guess I was saying, would someone actually keep going through to these people after seeing this idiot, you know, this sort of self-help schlock they're getting? Or do people actually use these advisors and seminars as you did so thoroughly and so patiently?
Oh, well, there were certainly other people at all these events.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so I was not a solitary traveler. They're, you know, white-collar people, when they, have that fatal day comes when they're told to clean out their desk in a half an hour and get out, they're traumatized, of course, and they're reaching out for help in every direction. Some of the help they're likely to be offered is, I think, really exploitative. You know, it's not going to really help you get a job, but either it's making money for somebody else or advancing some peculiar agenda. One of the things I was very shocked to find is that that evangelical megachurches have been moving in on the white-collar unemployed as a potential recruits. So you can go to a networking event thinking you're going to get job tips and connections, but in fact you're going to be proselytized for 2 hours or more if you keep sitting mm-hmm. there, which many, many people do, hoping some good will come of it. So it's a tricky world. You don't know what to do.
And you did in your first chapter, I guess, what I would have done. You go to what's called a career counselor, and this is now a growing profession, I take it, of people helping unemployed white-collar people.
Just since the mid-90s, a lot of things have sprung up. Because it was really in the 90s that the seismic change in the corporate culture took place. Away from seeing employees as assets and towards seeing them simply as expenses to cut. This is still going on. So white-collar, middle-class life has gotten much more tumultuous than it ever was, in our lifetimes, I think, before. And people do, you know, they're reaching out for help. How do you adjust to this new world?
And these career counselors, though, it's not like they're – I mean, it seems like anyone can claim to be a career counselor. It seems like there's a lot of people out there just throwing out what struck me is, to a large extent, psychobabble.
Yes, there is a tremendous amount of psychobabble. Well, it starts with the fact that everybody wants to give you a personality test. All these coaches do, and also corporations rely on them. For what purposes, it's hard to see, because these tests, like the Enneagram test, the Myers-Briggs test, have been thoroughly discredited.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people don't have the same personality from one day to the next with these tests.
Mm-hmm.
They're really silly. The first one I took, the guy concluded, my coach, you know, analyzed these results very carefully, and then he said that I was, on the positive side, a good and loving person. On the negative side, melancholy and envious, and all of this seemed to lead to the bottom line that I should avoid occupations that involved writing, because that was something I wouldn't be good at. But this is silly stuff.
Yeah.
And the effect of it is to say, well, it's not really the corporate world or the economy we have to think about here. It's you.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the reasons they're giving you the test is to talk about ways in which you need to improve your personality. In this case, you know, I had to work on that melancholy and enviousness.
No, this comes through in chapter after chapter very brilliantly, the sort of Calvinist American tradition of taking complete blame for one's condition if you're out of work. And I think any American who's been unemployed, and I think we all have at one time or other, know that in this culture, it's maybe one of the worst feelings on earth is to be out of work. White collar, maybe even more so than blue collar for cultural reasons. And it seems like a lot of what you were dealing with was people playing on that theme.
Well, I think that a lot of victim blaming goes on. If you think about this emphasis on attitude, which you encounter everywhere, you know, in mega bestsellers like Who Moved My Cheese and, you know, all the business advice books that I certainly encountered among coaches and group leaders, they're saying that you control what happens to you through your attitude. So if you have a bad attitude in any way, like if you're harboring some resentment over that last firing, that's going to trip you up because, well, I mean, it sounds ridiculous, but, you know, some people take this to the extent of saying, you control the universe through your attitude. If you beam out positive beams into the universe, you'll get whatever you want. So if things are not going right for you, it's really in you where the problem lies.
We're talking to Barbara Ehrenreich today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Barbara Ehrenreich is the author of the brand new book, Bait and Switch, The Futile Pursuit of the American Dream, just published this month by Metropolitan Books. Ehrenreich's the author of 13 books, including the best-selling Nickel and Dime. She's a columnist, a journalist, a social critic for many years, and it's an honor to have her. If you'd like to call in and have a question for Barbara Ehrenreich, the number here at Media Matters, 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. And Barbara, while I was reading this book, I mean, it's a wonderful, almost ethnography in a way, participant-observer, huge political and economic questions kept jumping out at me. I mean, I couldn't help avoid it. For one thing, I was wondering about, you know, the idea that corporations represent the sort of embodiment of market efficiency, that these are these institutions that are, you know, going to maximize the use of resources for production of goods and services in the Adam Smithian sense. And then the way you're describing the hiring processes and the internal politics, it just doesn't seem to jibe. I mean, it just seems like this sort of emphasis on niceness, on phoniness, isn't really necessarily the person who's going to be the most productive person in an enterprise.
No, I mean, you know, I've long been a critic of many corporate policies and corporations, both individually and collectively. But what I found in this experience is that I wasn't so much thinking about, well, the harmful drugs that this pharmaceutical company makes or the, you know, whatever the sins of various corporations. I was thinking, is this any way to do business? If you are hiring people on the basis of niceness and phoniness, and who they know, that is, through networking.
Sounds like we're talking about politics now.
Yeah, you end up with somebody like Michael D. Brown running FEMA.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There seems to be things that are actually going against getting the best people. For example, the age discrimination that is so prevalent in the corporate world, and I don't think it's been taken on sufficiently. You know, you're told right away that your resume should not have any experience that goes back more than 10 years,
mm-hmm.
so that you can pass for somebody under 40, at least in your resume. And what is that saying? That is saying we're not interested in experience. You know, it's a real devaluing of experience.
Well, it's interesting. If they're tossing workers aside as quickly as they are, you know, why not hire someone who's 53? Since you're not, even if you hire someone who's 28, you're not going to keep more than 5 years, maybe.
Right. Well, I don't know how those decisions are made.
Except they're cheaper, I guess, is the thing.
Yeah, it's cheaper, I guess, to get to the 23-year-old. And there's also the possibility that the older person will be somewhat more critical of what things going on within your company.
Yeah, that's true.
Which is not good. You can't be critical. And another thing which seems so counterproductive is that I began to see that a lot of the people who had been fired or were hearing the, you know, been threatened at their workplace were people who had been praised or promoted recently, or so they said. And so it took them as a complete surprise when they were let go. And yet they often attributed this to the fact that they were, in fact, doing well. Because if you're doing somewhat better than others, you might get paid better than others, and then you become a bigger expense and a more tempting cost cut.
You know, I'm reminded, as you say that, and as I read your book, I was reminded of John Kenneth Galbraith's book, The Culture of Contentment, from the early 1990s. I don't know if you recall that book.
No.
Well, in the book, he talks about how when these corporations were doing all these downsizing and layoffs, and Wall Street and the general public and the news media were applauding them for getting more efficient, Galbraith raised the question, well, why didn't anyone wonder why they hired these people in the first place if getting rid of them was so made them so lean and mean and efficient? And he made the point there that, you know, these are basically bureaucracies, just like in the public sector, really no different in many respects. And in a certain respect, basically, the people who get fired aren't necessarily the least efficient. They're the ones who might be the most efficient. They spend the less time politicking, and they might be actually doing their job. So they're most likely to get cut. So when the downsizing comes, it probably is going to make you less efficient, not more efficient.
Yeah, and then, of course, the effect of the downsizing on the survivors is also pretty traumatic because generally they're left doing the work of two people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have a situation where there are all these job seekers, and then we have all these people who are totally overworked. You find in a lot of the networking groups for the white-collar unemployed that half the people in the room will have a job right now, but they hear the drumbeat of layoffs or they just cannot take 14-hour days anymore.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the points that people often raise in this sort of discussion is say, well, look, the United States only has a roughly 5% unemployment rate. It's much lower than other advanced industrial economies like France or Germany. You know, so aren't we exaggerating here? Aren't you exaggerating in this book all the, you know, the unemployment, the threat of unemployment that faces workers in the United States?
Well, the 4-point-something percent unemployed at this moment, it's misleading in some ways, just like the official poverty rate is very misleading. One is that there are a lot of people, as a recent study has shown, Paul Krugman has written about this, a lot of people who give up. If you call their home as part of the monthly unemployment survey, they won't maybe count themselves as looking for work because they are babysitting neighbors' children or drywalling houses in the area or something like that. A more important thing that is neglected, I think, is there's no measure of underemployment. When someone loses their white-collar or professional or managerial job, eventually they end up taking whatever job they can find very often.
A sales associate often.
Huh?
A sales position.
Yeah, like a
Best Buy,
you know,
or something.
A Walmart sales.
A Walmart, yeah.
Circuit City or something like that. And then they disappear from the statistics because they're employed, right, officially. So that confuses the statistics. I would also point out along that line that it was very interesting. The last time we got unemployment numbers and poverty numbers, the unemployment rate had fallen slightly by a percentage point or so, but the poverty rate had risen, which does attest to the fact that a lot of jobs out there just don't cure poverty.
No, I wonder if that's ever happened before in American history, because that is such, on the surface, goes contrary to what we're always taught in economics courses.
Well, I always heard among liberals, for example, that full employment is the cure for poverty and for better wages for everybody. But in some way, jobs have been, you know, disconnected from you know, being real economic supports for people. So that poverty and employment now don't move up and down together.
We're talking to Barbara Ehrenreich today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Barbara Ehrenreich is the author of the brand new book, Bait and Switch, The Futile Pursuit of the American Dream, just published this month by Metropolitan Books. She's the author of 13 books in total, including the bestseller Nickel and Dimed. Ehrenreich is a prominent journalist and social critic, has written for Harper's, The Nation, The New York Times. Excuse me, if you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Barbara Ehrenreich, the number here at Media Matters, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now. Line 1, Champaign County, you're on the air with Barbara Ehrenreich.
Good afternoon. I'm more of the nickel and dime part of this social structure, but I'm curious that no one's called in. I mean, we have sort of upwardly mobile community here, and there seems to be this preoccupation with corporate egos on display, given these so-called reality shows, Apprentice and whatever Martha Stewart's film is, which are probably entirely scripted. I don't really know, but and they probably play on a lot of presumptions. I don't know if they're worthy of any comment or if you've endured any of that. But what you were just talking about, this. There is a Bureau of Labor Statistics does keep something on rehire, and I remember for Illinois a while back, it was something like 40% of the people that were rehired something. This I'm making this up, but a certain percentage of people rehired after losing a job were rehired at something like 30% less than they had before. So there are some statistics on that kind of downward mobility, and I'm just wondering. If you have anything to say about that generally, I know it's not entirely germane.
Oh, no, it is very germane.
Thank you.
Thank you for raising that,
yeah.
In fact. I think that the numbers that I have seen most recently are that 70% of people re-employed after a bout of unemployment are at lower wages than they had before. So there's an overall downward mobility that goes on. Now, some people, of course, land on their feet, start their own business, you know, do something, and maybe are in better shape. But that is a minority. And if you begin to see a lifetime career trajectory now, that instead of like in an earlier generation where you got your company job, you stuck with the company, you rose bit by bit, you retired with a pension. Today, it's the trajectory is going to be a lot bumpier. Many, many job changes, which means, of course, times without health insurance, too. And then when you get probably seeing your salary drop as those changes occur. And then finally, you just get too old, and they're not going to hire you because you're 45 or 50 or, God forbid, older than that.
You know, Barbara, one of the things that stuck out to me as I was reading Bait and Switch, knowing your politics pretty well, was periodically your ears would perk whenever anyone would mention anything about politics or draw it into sort of the analysis of their situation. But what was striking to me was how little of that there was that went anywhere, that someone would say, gee, you know, maybe if we had single-payer health care, I wouldn't have to be in this situation. Or some understanding of the political implications or explanations for the situation where people were in, it seemed that it was, depoliticized or apoliticized, but a critical analysis of the situation people were in was largely absent.
Well, right. In fact, I would say forbidden in most of these settings. There was a very telling moment in this boot camp I went to, which was supposed to whip us up into shape to be mean, lean, job-searching machines. And somebody, you know, commenting on the stress of overwork, which is the flip side of unemployment, said they want 14 hours a day now. It's rough. And our leader leaped on him and said, who are they? There's no they. You know, what are you talking about? We're talking about ourselves, you know, your personality, your attitude. So the subject was foreclosed just like that. And, you know, it struck me. I recently read start to cover Who Moved My Cheese? And, you know, that question is never answered in the book. The who is mysterious.
Mm-hmm.
There's no system. There's no bosses. There's no, you know, layers above you. The who is never identified.
So there's no politics, in other words. There's no social construction of the world we're in.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
No. But why bother? If you can control the world you're in with your thoughts and your attitude or your prayers in the evangelical version, why would you need to analyze anything?
We're talking to Barbara Ehrenreich today on Media Matters about her new book, Bait and Switch, The Futile Pursuit of the American Dream. The lines, we have a couple lines open at 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Barbara Ehrenreich will be appearing Friday, September 30th in Chicago, 7:30 p.m. at the Swedish American Museum. So make plans to be this coming Friday in Chicago. If you're up in that area, go to the Swedish American Museum, and you'll be signing copies of the book and, I guess, talking about Bait and Switch at the Swedish American Museum in Chicago. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 2, Champaign County, you're on the air with Barbara Ehrenreich.
Hi, Barbara. I enjoyed your nickel and dime book an awful lot. I think you and I are on the same wavelength politically, I think, and economically. I'd like you to comment on a couple of things. I'm visiting here from California, and we have lost literally tens of thousands of middle-class jobs because of offshoring of the jobs. One of the problems, I think, that people are going to have in terms of finding employment now is you can't find equivalent jobs for the ones that you lost, because any organized movement to get better pay and better wages leads to either you get fired or the company threatens to just offshore your jobs and the government lets them do it. Would you comment about that, and also comment about the fact that the only major jobs we see created are these Walmart-type jobs that don't pay a living wage, they don't pay any benefits, they have no health care related to them. There's somewhat of a disconnect in our society, I think. I mean, a lot of the people, if you look at where a lot of the really poor counties in the United States are, they're all in red states. I mean, to me, it just doesn't make sense how these people continually vote against their own self-interest. But they've been pretty much bamboozled into this.
All right, well, thank you very much, Colin.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of big questions there. Tom Frank wrote an excellent book, What's the Matter with Kansas?, trying to analyze, answer that question, why would people vote against their self-interest? And I could kind of see it in my search here in Bait and Switch, is that, I ended up in some mega churches which were offering some supposed services for the white-collar unemployed, as well as many other kinds of services. These churches are big social service centers. But they're also telling you, vote for the person who's against gay marriage. Vote for the person who's against abortion. And that is a code for vote for the person who is less likely to be in your economic self-interest.
When I was reading your chapter on the religious groups and their work on in this area, Barbara, it struck me a recent column by Katha Pollitt in The Nation, in which she talked about the growth of religion in recent times in the United States is corresponding possibly with exactly what you're talking about economically. That's filling this void of providing sort of an analysis and comfort zone for this increasing misery and sort of the collapse of public life. Is there a growth in religion, or is this just something we're recognizing? I mean, how does it fit in?
I don't know what it is, in terms of people's – the emotion of religion,
yeah,
whether that's growing. I mean, that my contact with the evangelical services in this book did not suggest a powerful spirituality or emotional religious drive. It's about a rather dry, bureaucratic mm-hmm. kind of God who is busy up there micromanaging your weight loss plan, your marital difficulties, your job search, whatever. There was no passion, at least in what I was seeing.
We're talking to Barbara Ehrenreich today in Media Matters, author of the new book, Bait and Switch, The Futile Pursuit of the American Dream. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 4, Edgar County, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. I had the opportunity to meet with you 2 years ago when you were at Indiana State and spoke at the speaker series, and also when you were at the Eugene V. Debs home. And I was wondering if you would comment about your thinking about Eugene V. Debs and what he accomplished or tried to accomplish, and also about the dramatization of your book, which has seemed to have been done several places in the country.
Well, thank you very much, Carla. And Barbara, you might want to, for some of our younger listeners, might explain who Eugene V. Debs is.
Eugene V. Debs, you helped me. I mean, might need some help here, but he was an early 20th century socialist leader in the United States, an anti-war leader who ran for president once from prison, he was in prison for opposing World War One, a good thing to oppose, I should say. So, I have enormous respect for him. The other question, Nickel and Dimed was turned into a play by Joan Holden, a playwright in San Francisco, and that play has gone, it's been performed and produced in many, many cities around the country, and in ways that Joan and I tried to devise to make those performances also occasions for getting people mobilized, tying these things to, groups that these performances to benefit, say, for affordable housing or for a living wage campaign and things like that.
You know, one of the things that came through in Nickel and Dime, there was this one section, it's been a couple of years, so forgive my memory, where you're talking about the lack of interest in the 2000 presidential election among your coworkers at one of your places of employment. And in this book, too, and I've talked about this already, just the sort of general lack of interest in politics outside of what seemed like at most a superficial level. This seems to be a recurring issue across the class spectrum in this country.
Well, I should correct that.
Okay.
You know, in some cases, and you know, we're only talking a very small, erratic kind of sample, but
sure.
I do want to point out that some of the people I interviewed for Bait and Switch, because I did at some point realize I was never going to really have satisfying conversations in the context of these networking events. So I did turn around and say, here's who I am, here's what I'm doing, can I interview you, to some of the people I'd met. And in the fall of 2004, several of them brought up to me without any prompting, because I wasn't taking the conversation that direction, that they were not going to vote for Bush, that they were furious about the economy.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's interesting. Okay, let's go back to the phone lines now. Our guest today, Barbara Ehrenreich, author of Bait and Switched. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air.
Hi, I am just delighted with this guest. She's saying everything I have believed and experienced. I wanted to point out that I experienced the same thing quite a few, a decade or more ago in the job search and health problems, both at the same time, in that they were blaming the victim. You know, if you did the right things and had the right thoughts, you would be healthy and get a job. And, if that's not a heavy load to bear. So I'm just saying thank you so much, and I'll hang up.
No, thank you very much, caller. Barbara, anything you want to...
Yes, well, thank you for that. This is a stream of American culture going back at least to Mary Baker Eddy through people like Dale Carnegie and in the mid-20th century, and then Est in the 1970s, this idea that it's all your attitude.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that there's a sort of no material world that you're up against. And it is ultimately victim blaming.
Do you think that some of this might be going on in community colleges and high schools and colleges now, so we're trying to train people to go into business or advertising or public relations, are they being sold a bill of goods?
Well, the title, Bait and Switch, of this book refers to the fact that people are continually drawn into corporate careers as a way to affluence and security. Business is the most popular major among undergraduates in this country. The MBA is the most popular graduate degree. This is where people think they will find security. So it may mean, I remember the student I talked to, it was quite poignant. He talked about how he really loved psychology, but that wasn't practical. So he would go into marketing, uses psychology, you know, to manipulate people. But, you know, they're not going to find that security.
And you know, you talk in the book about your father, who actually had one of these old school corporate careers, who actually worked his way up and worked for the same company for a career. Is that right?
Yeah, he started. He was an amazing story because he started as a copper miner, quite poor, and got an education with great difficulty, and eventually became a corporate executive. But during his executive career, there was no question but that you move up until you get that gold watch and pension.
And those days are gone.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the phone lines. Now our guest today, Barbara Ehrenreich, author of Bait and Switch, The Futile Pursuit of the American Dream. Line 2, Raleigh, North Carolina. Welcome to Central Illinois. You're on the air with Barbara Ehrenreich.
Thank you very much. It's a great program. I listen every week.
Oh, thank you.
I was given basically no choice but to either take a severance package or be fired, essentially, in the mid-90s from my job with a major corporation. And as a result, you know, my life pretty much turned upside down. And as I tried to find work in my field, I kept running into a couple of things. One was what I came to understand as workplace affinity. I was asked, because I was 43 at the time, I was asked how I could possibly work with younger employees and was I able to get along with younger managers than myself. I heard that many times. Another thing I heard was asked, well, do you really want to do a job like this at this stage in your life? And I didn't feel used up at all by that point.
43.
I'm sorry?
Yeah, this is at age 43. I'm just emphasizing that with astonishment.
And I still don't feel used up, even though I'm 53 now. And the second thing I ran into, and you've alluded to it, Barbara, was I pretty much felt like a rat in a maze in the sense that I found that in interviews I was being asked about skills that I didn't have, and I found that I kept trying to accommodate myself to those questions, and basically hiring decisions were not being made in my favor. I felt like I was chasing a moving target that moved with every single interview, and that was very frustrating. The third thing I ran into and still run into is I eventually sort of gave up on my field, which was telecommunications, and got into other areas. And yet, while working in those areas, when I tried to interview for a job back in my field, I was always asked, well, gee, I see you've been doing other things. Why do you want to return to this field now? As if, you know, it was totally under my control to either avoid my previous field or not. So You might care to comment on this. You have in some ways in your book, and it's a great book. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Barbara, do you have something you want to say?
Yeah, I would make one comment here. This caller has alluded to a real catch-22, which is if, you know, when you lose your job, well, you're going to have a gap in your resume, right, for a few months while you search. And the average job search now for white-collar people is 6 months. So you're going to have some gap, or you're going to do some odd jobs or jobs that are not what you know, want particularly. And all that's going to be held against you. The longer you're unemployed and not doing the kind of thing, in this case it's telecommunications, that you want, the less likely you are to ever get back in.
In fact, in the book there are many, I guess, tragic but also quite comic in a way, humorous ways. You talk about the gap and the fear of the gap on your resume and how that can be the killer for an interview. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 4 from Indiana. You're on the air with Barbara Ehrenreich.
Yeah, hi. Your study concerns economic mobility. I wonder if there is any relationship between economic mobility and physical mobility, that is, the willingness or unwillingness to move and how that might affect your economic fortunes. That was my question.
Thank you very much, caller. Yeah, Barbara, did the willingness to move, how does that factor into all this?
I'm not sure. In my attempt to get a corporate job, I made it clear that I was ready to go just about anywhere. So I wanted to remove that factor, any kind of limitation. So it's hard to say. Now, through the internet job sites, you can be applying for jobs all over the country. It doesn't matter really where you are so much anymore. So I don't know.
All right. Well, on that note, let's go back to our next caller. Line 1, Chicago, you're on the air with Barbara Ehrenreich.
Yeah, hi. My question probably has very little use at the present time, considering the political situation in the country. However, over 20 years ago, I was an employee for the state in an employment security, so-called unemployment compensation in the job service or the Illinois State Employment Service, whatever its name is now. Anyhow, when these operations were originally set up under Social Security back in the 30s, there was a requirement for counseling of the worker as to the type of job he could do, what he could do, testing, and all that sort of thing. And this was essentially eliminated beginning with Nixon when he started cutting funding for the employment service 10% a year, and it continued except for Carter's administration all the way until I was laid off. I was wondering whether you had any contact with the state agencies in your searching for jobs.
No,
I didn't. What effect, what your notion is of the whole situation?
They tend to be somewhat more focused on the blue-collar people and the pink-collar people.
Mm-hmm.
I was told that is not the way to get the kind of so-called executive level job, that is, you know, meaning something paying around $50,000 a year, that I was searching for. But what you're saying is very interesting, that maybe that's another reason for the growth of this so-called transition industry of people, groups and companies and individuals, I don't want to say preying off of, but, you know, focused on the white-collar unemployed, is because the government isn't providing those services anymore.
And it didn't seem like, from your book, that the people you're dealing with were expecting anything from the government. Their you know, expectations of the government were quite low.
And rightly so, sadly. You know, we haven't a strong welfare state. We don't have a safety net for people, and that 6 months of unemployment compensation is just not enough. It's very, you know, very inadequate compared to, like, most northern European countries. So people don't expect a lot. And as they expect less, they kind of withdraw more from thinking of electoral politics as being meaningful to their lives.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Barbara Ehrenreich, author of the new book, Bait and Switch. We've only got time for a couple more callers, so let's go back to the phone lines. Line 3, Lafayette, Indiana, you're on the air with Barbara Ehrenreich.
I was wondering about the experiences that I've had. It seems as though I can tend to be somewhat slow. People are very satisfied with the quality of my work, which is basically a technical type work, so you can judge the quality by how well the result actually functions. But I tend to be fairly slow, but the quality is good. And my experience is that people are increasingly concerned with speed. Get it done quick, and they kind of have a fixed price in mind. So if you're slow and good, well, you know, you're a whole lot worse of a person than if you're an average speed and do lousy work. And I'm thinking, have been thinking, that a lot of this may have to do with government oversight. You know, we're trying to determine whether or not the employer is discriminating against you for, you know, whatever reason. And I'm wondering if you had any comments on that.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Barbara?
Yeah, I just doubt very much it has anything to do with government oversight. There's not a lot of government oversight. It just sounds like this mentality, you know, let's just focus on short-term profits. Maybe the quality is lower, but we'll move faster. It just sounds like a lot of corporate thinking to me.
You know, when you were out doing this work, Barbara, I mean, because your book concludes saying, look, these are social problems that require social solutions, and that's really the only way we're going to get out of this. It's not going to be through self-help groups. Did you get a sense that the soil is fertile for progressive organizers, for people to come out and offer an alternative vision of social action to solve this problem, or do you think we've got a ways to go?
Well, I think we can start doing it right now. I'm on a book tour, and every time I speak to an audience, I, you know, try to get some people in the room to become local organizers, to create settings where job seekers, and I mean blue as well as white collar, can come together without exploitation, without other agendas being played out, and to think about their problems in a larger way, to perhaps do things like lobby for universal health insurance and more of an adequate safety net for the laid off.
This Friday, September 30th, Barbara Ehrenreich will be appearing in Chicago to talk about her new book, Bait and Switch, at the Swedish American Museum, 7:30 p.m. So if you're in the Chicago area, put that down on your calendar. Let's go to our final caller now. Line 2 on a cell phone in Urbana. You're on the air with Barbara Ehrenreich.
Yes, this might be beyond your purview, but I'm wondering whether you do know of people in Europe, for example, in other countries who've been doing studies parallel to yours of work from the inside.
Thank you, Colin.
Recently there has been some very interesting journalism. Well, not that recently. I guess it was in the 70s and 80s, where a German writer went undercover as a Turkish immigrant worker and wrote a book which was a big impact, at least in people's thinking, about the treatment of immigrant workers there. So I'm not the only one to have done this kind of research. There's one thing I do want to mention, not quite connected to that, but we were talking about organizing a minute ago, and I would like to invite people to come to my website where I will be posting resources where there will soon, and where people are invited to post their stories and can get in touch with other people, potentially other people in your area. And the website is BarbaraEhrenreich.com. That's one big word, and Ehrenreich is Ehrenreich.
Okay, BarbaraEhrenreich.com. Everyone should bookmark that. That's your assignment for this week. Barbara, we've only got about a minute or a minute and a half left. I was wondering if you could just give a sense of, because you are traveling around the country now, you have your ear to the ground as much as anyone I know. What is your sense of the political mood of the country now and sort of how it compares to 5 years ago or 10 years ago? Do you see any sort of trajectory that you can sink your teeth into out there?
Well, I think I'm thinking of a change just in 3 weeks or so.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the mood of the country has swung heavily against Bush, and I'm not the only one to observe this. The combination of Iraq and the fumbling over Hurricane Katrina, and all of that has really disillusioned people. I spent yesterday marching against the war here in Los Angeles, where I am now, and it was a very good turnout, remarkably diverse crowd. I think something is happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but where it's going to go, I guess, remains very much to be seen. What media do you use to sort of stand? What's your media diet look like?
Well, in normal life, not on a book tour.
Yeah, not on a book tour.
I get a hit of CNN in the morning. I read the New York Times. I read quite a few magazines, including The Nation, The Progressive, Harper's, The New Yorker, Scientific American, Discover. And some literary magazines now and then. I like to catch The Daily Show at the later in the day with more hits of CNN along the way.
Barbara Ehrenreich, I hear the band tuning up in the background, which means Tavis Smiley's pushing me out of the studio. And I want to thank you so much for joining us today on Media Matters. Barbara Ehrenreich is the author of the brand new book, Bait and Switch, The Futile Pursuit of the American Dream, just published by Metropolitan Books. Almost certainly to follow Nickel and Dime was a bestseller. Thank you again, Barbara, for joining us.
My pleasure.
And I want to thank Andrew Boyle, my terrific producer. And I will be back. I'm Bob McChesney 1 week from today with another guest here on Media Matters. Thank you very much.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
The forecast for Champaign-Urbana and East Central Illinois, cloudy with showers and thunderstorms likely today at a high near 80. Mostly cloudy with showers and thunderstorms likely tonight, low 65. Tomorrow, cloudy, a chance of showers and thunderstorms in the morning, then partly sunny with a high of 75. And on Tuesday, mostly sunny with a high in the mid-70s. You are listening to WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois.